What I was hoping to say was that Norman Gester will be in conversation with Lucas Whitman tonight at 7 at the Strand Bookstore. That's at 828 Broadway at 12th Street. Up next, with the start of March Madness and the baseball season right around the corner, Word Maven Patricia T. O'Connor will be taking your calls on the language of sportscasting. If you have a question about the language or sportscasting, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Write to us on our show page, WNYC.org, or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org.
Three little words, oh, what I'd give for that wonderful phrase. To hear those three little words, that's all I'd live for the rest of my days. And what I feel in my heart.
Joining me now is Patricia T. O'Connor, who is the author of a number of books about the English language and is a regular contributor to our show. It's always a pleasure to have you here, Pat.
Thanks for having me.
And when Patricia comes here, we take your calls on the intricacies of the English language. But, Patricia, you said that because of the fact that the baseball season is about to start,
right,
we have March Madness, we have all sorts of, this is a moment of convergence of sports.
It is. And, you know, we're more than ready for it because of the terrible winter. And spring does start tomorrow. And I guess people a lot of times think that spring really officially starts around April 1st or March 31st when the baseball season opens. So I thought I'd talk about
But wait, the baseball season is opening in Australia.
Well, oh, yes, yes, yes. For some teams, it is opening early in Australia. And I think domestically, it opens on the 31st.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder what happens to the ball when you hit it down under. Does it go backward?
I think it goes counterclockwise. Actually, who knows? But anyway, I do get a lot of calls from listeners about the language of sportscasting and sports in general, but especially on-air commentary. And there is one characteristic, well, several, that seem peculiar to sports commentary. And one of them is that the commentators often put the subject at the end of a sentence. For example, they'll say something like, different player since he came up from the minors, Jones. Or looks like he's recovered from his injury, Perez. Or that kind of thing. And in this kind of sentence, the subject is either postponed or delayed. And there may be a couple of reasons for this. The speaker may start talking, assuming the audience knows who he's talking about. And then, as an afterthought, insert the subject at the end. Or it may be that in the heat of play-by-play, you know, these commentators have a lot of names in their minds. He may start to talk about somebody and he's trying to remember now who's that guy again? Who's the shortstop again? And giving himself a little bit of time to remember. And we do this a lot. We, for a variety of reasons, in our own speech, we'll say, good boy that Johnny. We don't have to say he is a good boy, that Johnny. It's understood when you're speaking. And actually, this is something that linguists have studied. That, yes, you know, they study everything. But there are some who've actually studied the language of sports commentary, and they call this parataxis. It's called, it's from a Greek term, which means placing side by side. And what it means is that loose sentence fragments are strung together, often without explicit grammatical connections.
I thought that it might be more like what happens with German, where you have the verb at the end of the sentence. There must be some other language out there somewhere where you put the noun at the end of the sentence. And
sure. But I don't think that sports commentators are doing this because of
they're
the
not translating
of
from
no,
some
I,
obscure
no, I don't think Phil
language
Rizzuto
on New Guinea Papua.
No, I don't think so. You'll find sometimes that even the ordinary things that we assume are crucial to an English sentence are missing sometimes in sports commentary. For instance, you'll hear something like, strong bullpen, the Twins, or needs a walk here, Jones. It's almost stream of consciousness. And, you know, say what you will. I've often said that there's a difference, a big difference between the various Englishes spoken and written. And I get a lot of flack about that because people say, well, English is English. It should all be correct. Well, there are different registers or means of communication. And
listeners
seem to understand it.
I'm just filled with admiration for most sportscasters because I've thought about what it would be like to just have to fill up all that time.
Oh, right.
Often when there's nothing to say.
Right,
and yet
right.
they just find things to say,
right.
or if they're good anyway. And it can be really enjoyable listening to a knowledgeable sportscaster. On the other hand, it can be quite boring if the sportscaster is just simply telling me what I'm already seeing
on
television.
It seems that sportscasters have two main problems to deal with. One is where you mentioned there's nothing going on. So they have to have some kind of patter that's reasonably intelligent. The second situation is where there's so much going on, they have multiple plays going on almost simultaneously, and they have to get that sequence of events across in a meaningful manner. They can't come back later and explain it.
But all sorts of – we're already getting questions from listeners, and there are all sorts of words that we associate with sports that
mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, there's the complaint often that politicians use sports metaphors as a way of connecting with people. But also there are just these words like Tom in California says in baseball, a balk is when the pitcher makes a motion to pitch the ball and then doesn't, and wonders how that came about.
Well, it's probably just from the ordinary word
balking.
To balk.
Yeah,
or,
but you could have done all sorts of other words, other things to say that, couldn't you? False
you could,
move.
You could. But I think that in sports, the preference is for a more colorful term, not for the ordinary average term. Like, take the term bullpen. It originally meant just literally a pen for the enclosing animals. And later on, later in the 19th century, it took on other meanings, and it came to mean any kind of enclosure. And it's used in journalism, and it's used in sports.
Mm-hmm.
And one interesting thing about bullpen is you'll notice that in live on-air commentary, often bullpen is used without an article. For instance, the commentator will say, Jones to bullpen, or they liked him in bullpen, or he's got a lot of strength to call on from bullpen, or you can't throw 200 pitches in bullpen and not pay the price physically, something like that. Now, this happens more often in speech than in written sports journalism, but it often sometimes happens even in print. It kind of washes over into print journalism, which I think is very interesting. But the article dropping, that may not be peculiar just to sports commentary, because it happens in other areas of journalism too. Listeners have written to me about phrases like on premises or on scene, as in, this is Anderson reporting on scene. Or, now back to Brian, in studio. So they'll leave off articles in other areas of journalism, too.
And why do you think that is?
I don't know. It's a clipped sort of usage, and it doesn't particularly save any time. I don't know. I can understand why in sports commentary you'd do it, because bullpen is almost, it's almost become not a location that deserves an article, but it's almost like a city, the city of bullpen. He's in bullpen.
I'm curious about pitcher, because
uh-huh.
a pitcher is obviously something that contains liquids.
Uh-huh.
A pitcher is somebody who is trying to sell a product.
Uh-huh.
And a pitcher is somebody who throws a baseball.
Right.
I'm assuming that the baseball connection comes out of the pitch of
the technical term for it is the delivery of the ball to the batter, but pitch has been used for hundreds of years to mean throw.
Really?
You pitch something. Yeah, pitch me that screwdriver. Or, yeah, it means to throw.
So how do we wind up with it being so many different things? A container for liquids, for example.
The container for liquids, that may come from a whole other root. That I haven't, let me look that up. I've got two dictionaries here. The Baseball Dictionary by Paul Dickinson,
yeah.
Or Dixon, I'm sorry, Paul Dixon, which I recommend for any fan, really ought to have it around. Now let me see.
I'm not trying to cause you trouble here, Pat.
You're not going to cause me trouble?
I'm not trying to.
I know. You're not, you don't have to try.
I guess we've all wondered about how these terms came about.
Okay, yeah, the pitcher that is a container for liquid, it's an alteration of a word that started with B in Latin, bicarium, Greek bikos, possibly for a jar. So I think it's an entirely different word than a pitch that means a throw.
And then a pitcher can also be a 7-iron in golf.
It can.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there. I don't know golf.
So,
but I'm looking further here in the throwing sense. Yeah, it comes from Old English. So, the pitcher that holds something, the vessel, comes from classical roots, and the pitch that means to throw is from Old English.
This is what makes English such a confounding language.
It is, but it's interesting. I think it's much more interesting than if we still spoke Latin. It would have had to change a lot, let me tell you that.
But we have these words like L-I-V-E, live, live.
Yeah.
R-E-A-D, read,
right.
Read. And it goes on, and I to confound people who come to this country and are trying to figure out how to speak or read English.
I don't think
English.
It was designed just to confound people. But I did want to talk about another baseball reference.
Okay.
Because this one is really fascinating. Baseball is very famous for this quirk of language. In baseball, the past tense of fly is not flew, it's flied. Now, it's very interesting how this came about. We all know that the past tense of the old verb fly is flew. But the verb fly, meaning to a fly ball, or to fly, meaning to hit a fly ball, is a new formation. And it's based on the noun fly. And when new verbs enter English, they invariably are given the modern ED endings instead of the old Anglo-Saxon endings that the older verbs would have had. So that's why the past tense of fly, meaning to hit a ball in baseball, is flied. As in, he flied out. And this has been true since the 1870s, at least. There was a game reported in the Boston Globe in 1872 about a game between the Boston Red Stockings and the Philadelphia Athletics. Cuthbert flied out to Harry Wright. That's in the Dixon Baseball Dictionary. And the OED has one. A bit later from the Chicago Tribune, Kittredge flied out to Brody. That one was about a game between the Chicago Colts and the Boston Bean Eaters. So anyway, for more than 100 years, that new verb to fly has had the typical ED ending of new verb formations in English.
And fly is another one of those words that can mean so many different things.
Yeah.
Like the insect.
Right.
Like the zipper on
yes.
trousers.
Yes, and you use it as an adjective. Somebody is real fly, slick-looking, elegant.
Let's take a call from Lucas from the Lower East Side. Hi, Lucas. You're on the air.
Hello there, Leonard. A common term in baseball is RBIs, runs mm-hmm. batted in.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't it be RSBI? Because after all, we're not saying run batted ins.
Mm-hmm.
It's or am I being too syntactically pure?
No, actually, that's an issue that a lot of baseball fans who are also sticklers for English mention RBIs as an example of an unnatural plural, but actually it's not. The plural of the longer form would be runs batted in, but when it becomes an initial formation, initialism, RBI, the S is added to the end of the formation. Just say, as in, say, Federal Bureau of Investigation. If there were two of them, we wouldn't say FB's I. We'd say FBI's.
Okay.
I mean, there aren't, but you get my
meaning.
One
is enough.
One is enough, right.
I get your drift, and thank you.
And J. Edgar Hoover thanks
exactly.
you so much for that. We have James. Hi, James from Forest Hills. You're on the air.
Yes, Miss O'Connor, thank you for taking my call. I have to attribute this question to Warner Wolf, who used to be a sportscaster in the New York City area.
I remember him.
He often wondered,
yeah.
Pardon me?
I remember him very well.
He often wondered why the foul pole in the outfield was referred to the foul pole rather than the fair pole, since the pole is actually in fair territory.
I don't know. Let me see if Dixon has anything about that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Well, whether fair or foul.
Yeah, foul pole.
Fair or foul meaning something else.
Oh, yeah, foul pole. Yeah, Dixon says it's either of two vertical poles at the intersection of the outfield fence and the foul line. It aids the umpires to determine if a ball that is hit over the fence is fair or foul. A batted ball that hits the foul pole on the fly is a home run. Let me see. See also fair pole. There's also a term fair pole. So let me go to that one.
I've
Who
never
knows?
Heard fair
go
pole.
Go to the videotape. Isn't that what Warner Wolf always used to say?
Yes, let's go to the tape.
Yeah, okay. Let me see. Fair pole. A term popular among sportscasters for foul pole because a ball that strikes the pole is considered a fair ball. So there you go. Some people like to call the foul pole a fair pole.
And we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we will talk more about the English language. A lot of people are calling in, Pat, with things that have nothing to do with sports. But
that's okay.
you know, there are just so many hilarious things that happen with sports, as Marty Glickman. I'll tell a story later of Marty Glickman told on the air. Even if it is a little off color, it still is hilarious. We'll be back with Pat right after this.
Give to hear those three little words.
We are back with Patricia T. O'Connor, and we're talking about the language today, about the language of sports, as part of our ongoing discussion about the idiosyncrasies of our mother tongue. And our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WMYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So very briefly, Marty Glickman, who was a great athlete, but also one of the best sportscasters ever. He had really hilarious stories to tell. And one of them occurred fairly early in his career, where he was broadcasting a college basketball game, and the point guard was for a New York team, I think it may have been NYU or Manhattan College, was a young, or St. John's, was a man named Urea. So he says, Urea dribbles down the court, and then here's big laughter from his cohort and realizes that he's going to have to deal with this the whole game because he's the point guard, the one who does all of the dribbling. Okay, well, you have another thing you want to say before we get to some more calls?
Oh, actually, I did want to mention, when I talked about flied, as in flied out, the same thing happened with the term line drive. To hit a line drive, the past tense is he line-drived.
Wow, I've never heard that.
And those are accepted dictionary usages for baseball because they are new formations. on old nouns.
Should we take some calls that don't have anything to do with sports?
Sure, why not?
Okay. This person's been hanging on the line for a long time. Mickey from the Bronx. Hi, Mickey. You're on the air.
Hi, Lenny. Good to speak with you. Hello, Patricia.
Hi.
I have a question. A couple of weeks back, you were interviewing a guy about ports around the city, metro area, and he mentioned that longshoreman was an American word. And I understand that the word longshore is an Irish word, meaning men who work the docks. So Patricia, do you know about that?
I don't. I'm looking right as we speak. I'm looking it up.
Well, if you're
longshore,
looking at...
Well, no, it just says a dock worker who loads and unloads ships.
Yeah, it doesn't give a derivation, right? Well,
no.
I'll tell you, most of these dictionaries that we've been using for centuries are all English written or Anglo-American written, and they often totally disregard any Celtic references, especially Irish.
I know what you're going to say.
Yeah.
Especially since your name is O'Connor.
Well, yes, I hate to be a traitor to my own race.
Don't do it. You're talking to a fellow Irishman. So
yeah, okay. Okay, so sue me. But there is a... you're probably referring to that book that says that the Irish invented everything. So many Irish words came from, or so many English words came from Irish. I've done a lot of research on some of those words, and it doesn't exactly pan out. A lot of those derivations are mythological. And I've done a piece on my blog about them.
You're saying it's all blarney?
Well, considerable amounts of it are blarney.
Although I'd imagine that because English is so welcoming.
Right.
And we take words from all over.
We do.
And since the Irish speak English.
Right.
A lot of Irish people in England, there are a fair number of words. And then also the Irish are so important to literature.
Right.
I'm still trying to figure out what James Joyce was writing in Finnegan's Wake.
the point I want to make is, though, that a lot of the people who argue for Irish derivations for huge swaths of the English language argue that there's a conspiracy to suppress this information among Anglo linguists and whatnot. And I can tell you that I don't know that many Anglo linguists.
Well,
I'll
confess to it. I'm part of the conspiracy.
No, but I'm serious. I know a lot of linguists. They're only too happy to be able to track down derivations that really pan out, and a lot of the things that are attributed to the Irish are fictional. Sorry to have to say it.
John from Paramus.
Yes, Lenny. Hi, how you doing? Red Barber used to use a phrase when a batter was in an advantageous position, saying he's in the catbird seat. So I was wondering, what is a catbird seat?
A minute here. That's one of the things that Dixon writes about. And if you, again, if you like baseball, this would be a good...
I'm going to get that book.
Yeah. Catbird seat. It was popularized in the 40s by Red Barber when he was an announcer for the Dodgers.
Yeah.
And he described it as a batter with a count of 3 balls and no strikes, or a pitcher with a big lead, was said to be in the catbird seat. And he'd say things like Twins, Giants in the catbird seat, as those two teams were on the verge of clinching their playoff berths. There are some sports books that try to get to the bottom of this. And when supposedly Barber got the idea of doing the catbird seat for the New Yorker magazine, James Thurber decided to do a piece on the catbird seat for the New Yorker, and he did a satirical sort of column on the derivation of it. And Variety said it was going to make a motion picture out of the catbird seat, but that never actually happened.
So we don't know.
Right. Well, let's see. We know it's attributed to Barber, And he says that in his biography, Rhubarb in the Catbird Seat, he says that while he played penny ante poker in Cincinnati with friends, he sat for hours unable to win a hand. And finally, he decided he was going to force the issue in a game of a seven-card stud. He raised the first bet, and he raised again on every card. And at the end, when the showdown came, it was between one other guy and Barber, and the other guy, Frank, turned over his whole cards, showed a pair of aces, and won the pot. He said, "Thank you, Red. I had those aces from the start. I was sitting in the catbird seat." And so Barber picked it up. And so it's never really been satisfactorily explained how his poker-playing friend got it, but it is known that if you're in on a lofty perch as a cat sitting in a tree, you have a seat up there, and you could call yourself that you have the catbird seat.
Now, the other name in his book is Rhubarb, and they did mm-hmm. make a movie called Rhubarb about
oh, yeah?
a cat named Rhubarb who uh-huh. Inherits a baseball team. It was one of the great films of my youth, so I remember it well. But Rhubarb is another one of his phrases, Rhubarb being a big disagreement.
Uh-huh, boo-ha-ha, sort
yeah,
of.
So I guess in the case of Red Barber, he just had a very colorful way with the language. Marty Glickman told a story about being very young broadcaster with Red Barber doing a World Series, and he, at the beginning, he said to Red, who was already highly esteemed, and he was just a young guy, he said, "So who do you think's going to win this series, Red?" And Red said, "That's why they play these games, Marty." And I've always loved that. I thought, well, that is, whenever anybody asks me who's going to win the Super Bowl or the World Series, I tell
that
story.
That's why they play those games, Marty.
Well, thank you for calling us. In the end, I assume that if you are Red Barber and you start using a phrase,
yeah,
and you are one of the greatest broadcasters that ever lived,
oh, yeah,
it's just going to become part of baseball lore.
Yeah.
But you don't hear anybody else saying catbird seat.
Well, I've actually heard the phrase. It just means that you're in a position of advantage to be in the catbird seat. But I never understood what a catbird seat was.
Yeah. Well, we can imagine it's one of those metaphors mm-hmm. that is evocative. It doesn't really have to be totally explained, like any idiom.
Right.
We go now to John from Bradley Beach, New Jersey. Hi, John.
Hi. A catbird is an actual type of bird. It's very much like a mockingbird.
Mm-hmm.
And if you pay attention to birds, you will notice this bird will sit in a most conspicuous place, making a lot of noise often, but where it can really see its surroundings really well, if it's the tippy top of a tree or the corner of your roof or something. So that's sort of, it's a bird that sits in the most advantageous place. So that's why, I mean, that makes sense. It's not this crazy metaphor. It makes perfect sense, actually.
Oh, thank you for that. And, you know,
I have one more. Let me add about rhubarb. I thought Leonard might know this, but
I like
rhubarb.
Rhubarb pie.
Meaning uh-huh. some big brouhaha, because in the early days of radio, if they wanted to make it sound like there was an argument or a disagreement, they would just have three people stand around each other, the microphone, and say, "Rhubarb, rhubarb, rhubarb, and you should try it." And it just sounds like a big argument or disagreement. That's how that came about.
And that was the start of Fox News, wasn't it?
Right.
Thank you for calling us. Peter, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. You might remember on Selected Shorts, they did a reading of Thurber's short story, an excellent reading about in the catbird seat, by the way. So addicts to or WNYC will remember that reading from Selected Shorts. Anyway.
Wanted to know about hat tricks.
Yeah, that hat trick, that's a term from broadening this to hockey. I just learned that recently, a hat trick. Also, in football, they have a gridiron, and in baseball, they have a birdie. I'm just wondering the origins of those phrases for other sports.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can tell you about hat trick. It actually started in cricket in the early 19th century, and a bowler in cricket was said to score a hat trick if he took three wickets in three successive balls. And supposedly it was called a hat trick because the club would award the player a new hat or the equivalent, maybe the price or something. And then the use of the term spread in the early 1900s, and it was used in horse racing for a jockey that won three races. And it also, as we know, is most famously known in ice hockey, where it refers to a player scoring three goals in a game.
And then people start throwing their hats on the ice in celebration.
Oh, but, you know, hat trick is also used in baseball. It's not an official word by any means, but it has been used in baseball for some kind of threefold accomplishment.
Wow.
A batter hitting into three double plays in a game, a batter hitting three homers in a game, a pitcher stopping three team losing streaks, various things.
So I'm glad you mentioned cricket, because it occurs to me that cricket is played on a pitch.
Yes.
I don't know if that means anything.
Right.
But the British do claim that we stole baseball from them.
There are similar games, rounders. And baseball, the term, originated in Britain. But it was not the baseball that we know.
Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. From Scotch Plains. Go ahead.
Yes. I just have a question, and I don't know if it's me not knowing the correct usage of the word or not, but typically during the NCAA tournament, after a commercial break, they'll come back and they'll have a nice graphic on the screen saying game reset, and it'll show, you know, the score and the rebounds and et cetera and all the other statistics. But to my way of thinking, reset would imply everything set back to zero, and where proper would be like maybe game status, or am I wrong on this?
It beats me.
Yeah.
That's over my head.
But reset has become one of the words that you find. I know when I check out what the Knicks have been doing on an iPhone app,
right,
it'll say game reset, and it really is a recap.
I see. Why do they call it a reset? Instead of a recap.
You know, Pat, you came here to clear things up. In fact, now I'm totally confused about everything. And I realize that part of this may just be that you have to know these things to be a true fan of each individual sport. So
yes,
if you're a football fan, you know what blitz means.
Yes.
You know what, some of them are obvious, like kickoff. But
right.
What does touchdown mean? Are you touching it down?
Yeah.
You know, there are all sorts of phrases that you have to know to really understand a sport. And that is a way of separating the fans or the knowledgeable from the rest of us.
Right. I'm part of the rest of us. But I do have a really knowledgeable friend who is a real baseball fanatic, one of the statistical kinds. And he even says that there's a difference between quick and fast in baseball. Yeah, that quick has to do with reflexes, with doing things automatically, and fast is just mere speed.
Yeah, and fast is also throwing a pitch at 98 miles an hour.
Yeah, that's fast.
Now, you're going to be back sometime in the near future. I don't have the date.
Yeah, I think it's sometime in May.
But people can reach you on your...
Right, grammarphobia.com. I answer questions there, and...
And then they can read all of your books.
Yeah, and for all the people who are of Irish heritage, you can look it up on my blog, that thing I was talking about.
May 20th? Okay.
See you then.